Hey there, I'm Sean Finnegan, and you are listening to Restitutio, a podcast that seeks to recover authentic Christianity and live it out today. What is the true nature of God? How should we understand monotheism? What about heresy? In today's interview, I ask Dr. Dale Tuggy about his new book, Monotheism, Heresy, and the Bible, published by Theophilus Press. Our discussion ranges from handling proof texts that call Jesus God to the role of logic in sorting out doctrine to how and when it's appropriate to call a belief a heresy. We also talk about the tendency of Trinitarians to defend their doctrinal convictions by appealing to mystery. In case you don't know him, Dale Tuggy is an analytic philosophy with a BA from Biola, an MA from Claremont, and a PhD from Brown University. He had a career teaching philosophy and adjacent subjects at the State University of New York at Fredonia for 18 years, after which he founded the Unitarian Christian Alliance, which seeks to help Unitarian Christians connect with each other, promote scholarship, host conferences, publish books, and participate in debates. Here now is episode 661, Monotheism, Heresy, and the Bible with Dale Tuggy. Welcome to Restitutio, Dale Tuggy.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
Now, you've come out with a new book called Monotheism, Heresy, and the Bible, published by Theophilus Press. Tell us a little bit about this book and why you wrote it.
Well, I'm the king of unfinished material. I have several other unfinished book projects, and what I realized I'd been doing was preparing stuff enough to do a presentation at a conference or a couple of Sunday school classes and things like that, or blog posts, podcast episodes, and then never really developing them fully in their arguments like I would if it was a journal article.
Yeah.
I've also decided now that I'm old and cranky that journal articles are kind of a waste of time. So I'd rather publish a book with 11 chapters in it than try to get 11 articles accepted in journals. Yeah, there are political or ridiculous delays. It's a crapshoot depending on what referees you get. They can be wonderful or they can be terrible.
And then it gets locked behind a paywall, right?
Yes, a lot of times. That's not as bad as it used to be, but yeah, depending on the journal, then people can only see your preprint version. I realized I had things to say on those three topics. And, you know, really a lot of it is engaging what I consider to be my people. You know, Paul is all concerned about the Jews. He's a Jew of Jews. I was raised basically in mainstream evangelicalism. You know, I went to Biola. I used to be very active in the Society of Christian Philosophers. To a lesser extent, I participate a little bit in the Evangelical Philosophical Society. And so I'm making arguments to the earlier me, somebody who's just assuming the Trinity and the deity of Christ. And isn't that just what Christians have always thought? And come on, how hard is this? It's very easy to prove from the Bible, things like that. So there's different things going on. I mean, the big chapter one, in a way, I view that as kind of continuing the argument of that debate book that I was in a couple of years ago. In that book, William Lane Craig, the famous Christian apologist, evangelical apologist, he was supposed to argue for the Trinity on the basis of the Bible, and he burned almost his entire chapter talking about how Jesus is called God 8 times in the New Testament, according to him. One more than Murray Harris. Like, what is this guy even doing? Like, I think Jesus can be called God. Like, why does he think this is proving the Trinity? And as I was responding to it, I realized that he thinks that Jesus, his assumption, that's an unexamined assumption, is that Jesus is called God because Jesus is divine. And because he's a Trinitarian of a certain sort, he thinks the kind of divinity is not the kind of divinity that implies being a God, but rather it implies being a person within a God, within the one God.
Yeah.
And I realize, well, wait a second, that theos never means that in the Bible. Not according to Dale Tuggy, not according to biblical Unitarians, according to the stinking lexicon. So what are you even doing? Like, how? Why do you think this is helping your theological case at all? It's totally not. So yeah, Jesus is called God in the Bible, I think maybe at least twice, but that's hardly even a significant point, really. it doesn't really get the Trinitarian anything that they need, because very simply, being called God doesn't imply having a divine nature according to scripture.
Are you kind of surprised that he had that unexamined assumption that he just thought, if I could show that the Bible calls Jesus God, then the Trinity? I can certainly expect that from your run-of-the-mill YouTube apologist, but this is William Lane Craig. You have two PhDs, one in German. Why do you think he didn't see this sort of unexamined assumption as an analytic philosopher?
Part of it is his views on the Trinity are similar to those of William Hasker, and Hasker has a more theologically developed bunch of stuff. I think they talked, and Hasker was like, okay, I'll do the theology, but you do the Bible. And Craig's like, aha, these silly Unitarians, they can't abide Jesus being called God, which, well, yes, we can. Like, does he even know anything about us?
Yeah, he might not have actually read or studied much of what we've been saying for a long time.
Yeah. Part of it, too, is he's very evangelical in that really, it's the deity of Christ that he cares about. And the Trinity is largely interesting just to the extent that it safeguards the deity of Christ.
Right.
You know, he threw in a few pages at the end in which he gave two different Trinity theories, one of which wasn't even Trinitarian at all, and the other one was very poorly developed. So theoretically, like, he was really half-baked and half-hearted effort. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he just thought this was a killer move. You know, he had all this rhetoric about sticking a dagger in the heart of Unitarianism and stuff. And it was the Jesus is God stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, I go through his eight passages that he discusses.
Well, could you sum up what you say about them? You know, obviously we can't get into each of the eight, but, you know, just as general summary, what is your approach?
So my approach is, I know a little bit of Greek, but I'm not great with it. But I know enough that I can consult the opinions of the top level experts. Mm-hmm. If I encounter like a medium level expert like James White, it doesn't really faze me because I already can study what the top level experts are all saying about all these passages. Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of them just don't really seem to get the Trinitarian anywhere because they face textual problems and translation problems. And so, like, what are we even doing? Like, why we try to build the doctrine on what is truly an ambiguous passage? And half the Trinitarians are saying, no, it's not really calling Jesus God. John 1:1, I put a lot more effort into that, and I explain how it's just not Trinitarian. And as best I can tell, earlier interpreters, you have to look really hard to find evidence for this in church history, but I think there's reason to think that you've got dynamic monarchian readings, modalistic monarchian readings, and logos subordinationist readings, and they all make more sense than the Trinitarian readings. But I think ultimately the dynamic monarchian one makes the most sense. I mean, take the logos theorists. This comes up again in the later chapter where I go in some depth into Origen's views. They read, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So there's a God, and there's the God that God is with. So there's two gods. They're like, what could be clearer? You got God number one, God number two. Mm-hmm. Well, what about the Jewish background? You know, are you really sure we want God number two? That's what the other guy said. So yeah, I've got a discussion of John 1 that talks about what's going on in that whole passage. And I even get into the somewhat weird BDAG entry for Theos.
Yeah, it is interesting.
I think it's weirdly organized, sort of poorly organized, and they're clearly trying to throw the Trinitarian a bone at one point, which doesn't really make sense. And so I argue that you can organize the meanings a little bit differently. Basically, there's a category of uses of the word theos where it's for ones who are like God or related to God in some important way. You know, a king would fit in that category. But the Messiah is like very unique in that way. He's uniquely related to God and uniquely God-like, right? If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. I try to sort of clean up the mess a little bit, just make it conceptually a little bit better. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I probably shouldn't have put this chapter first because it's super duper long and somewhat technical.
Yeah, but it's the chapter that you wish you had when you started on your journey, right? I mean, that's kind of what you say in the intro, that like, man, I wish I'd do this stuff
just to clarify words like God and Lord and go through these main verses.
Yeah, I was shocked years ago, I think when I was late in my grad school career. I mean, I had been told that, you know, sometimes God and Lord refer to various of the Trinity. And when it doesn't specify, well, in those cases, it's talking about the triune God. And, you know, people like James White will say that occasionally. And it's just it's just flat wrong. It's completely wrong. It's not what any of the actual experts in the languages say. And so then as a Trinitarian, you're confronted with this very uncomfortable fact that not only does the word Trinity not occur, that's not a killer point all by itself, but there just wasn't a word that or any string of words that was understood to refer to a tripersonal God in those times. And that's very, very strong evidence that they're not Trinitarian.
Yeah.
And much later, I learned that if you look in the patristic Greek lexicon, so not the Koine Greek one, New Testament era, but the one that's more for like Eusebius and Cappadocian fathers and things like, and later figures all the way up to late antiquity or early Middle Ages. Like there is a usage of God for the Trinity there.
Right.
Like, well, in Latin, it's in Augustine and it's in Greek and various other authors here and there, like Gregory of Nazianzus. Yeah. What's going on with all this God and Lord stuff? You know, do we need to call God by God and Jesus by the correct Hebrew names? No, I don't think so. I've got a little section on that.
There are endless varieties of Christianity, right? And some of them will make the big point. You have to call him Yahshua or Yehoshua or Yeshua or some other variant. And, you know, there's endless permutations of how to say God's name that people fixate on, right?
It's like you're trying to swim across a lake and there are these little whirlpools that keep sucking people in. And it's like, don't swim over there, man. Like, yeah, people get weird and weirdly self-righteous. Like they're proud that they know this God's secret name. Like this is some kind of achievement.
Yeah. And
don't get me wrong. I like Bible translations that use God's proper name in the Old Testament where it occurs. Yeah. I think that's actually kind of important. It changes the flavor of the translation. Or say Lord Yahweh instead of Lord God with capitals for God.
Yeah.
And for Lord. I like all that. I just don't think God cares what language you speak. And in different languages they use different equivalent proper names.
Yeah.
So like why would he care? Like well, I just think he would like all the different things that his most important creatures used to refer to him.
Well, let's talk about philosophy a bit. Quite a few Christians are skeptical of philosophers. What value should the church put on philosophy? I remember some time ago I was presenting about how Greek philosophy has infiltrated Christian doctrine such that people didn't want to live on earth in eternity. They wanted to instead go to Plato's Pleroma or something. And I remember in the questions and answers, you were like, wait a second, not all philosophy is bad, Sean. Just because there's bad philosophy doesn't mean there's not also good philosophy. So
yeah.
I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit, because you are writing as a philosopher.
Yeah, I am. And I don't really hold back a lot either. I mean, I'm trying to make it clear, but I'm also not oversimplifying either. Part of what's going on is historical and cultural differences. So in ancient times, quote, schools of philosophy were really like cults. And sometimes they were just visibly like cults. Like Epicurus was this cult leader that had a compound and people lived in it where they practiced the philosophical way of life, which is what he told them. He was their master. They were his disciples. I mean, they believed in gods, but they kind of made them irrelevant.
Okay.
But in many ways, it functioned like a religion or a quasi-religion, like Marxism or communism or self-helpism and things like that in the modern age. Platonism, if you've ever read the start of Justin Martyr's Dialogue with Trypho, he talks about going through different schools of philosophy. He's not just like a kid taking college classes at the state college. He's really this spiritual seeker.
He's trying to find a guru or something, right? Like just going from one to another.
Basically, paraphrasing, he says that as a Platonist, he was expecting shortly to experience God, you know, to get his mind up in the realm of the forms and the good. He's calling the good or the form of the good God,
yeah,
which they did in that era. And later on, Neoplatonism, I mean, these are explicitly competitors to Christianity. They didn't like the Christians. They're writing polemical works against them. They think they're ridiculous. They don't believe in the resurrection, etc. So, you know, when Paul's like, don't be led astray by deceitful philosophy and so on, that's much more analogous to somebody getting sucked off the correct Christian path by a self-help guru or a cult leader or something like that in our day. So since ancient times, right, at a certain point, the Christian emperor closed the academy at Athens, and that kind of brought an end to the Athenian philosophical tradition. Mm-hmm. You had other centers of it, like Alexandria. That big library burned down, so that kind of took half the fun out of that. But over the course of the Middle Ages, they essentially, in Western Europe, invented universities. They kept alive as many of these classic Greek and Latin philosophical works as they could, but then they interpret them in a Christian context as much as they could, which sometimes led to controversy, like about the works of Aristotle. Ever since the Middle Ages, like this has become a very serious academic subject, just like physics or biology or psychology. And it's really not anything like smoking dope and talking about the meaning of life with people late one night, or climbing up to the top of the mountain and consulting a guru that wears a diaper and asking them what the meaning of life is. It's as serious as death and taxes. And it's an incredibly interesting subject. And as concerns belief in God, it's really wholly innocent. Some great recent philosophers are Christians, and they do really great work in philosophy, and all the philosophers realize that it's really good work. And you got some agnostics, you got some atheists, you got some people in other religions like Islam or Hinduism or Buddhism. But there's just nothing inherently anti-Christian about philosophy any more than there is about history or biology or psychology. But there's crappy philosophy, just like there's crappy all these other things. Mm-hmm. But honestly, it's philosophers are going to tell you what's the good work and the really serious and worthwhile and helpful work. And then what is just the people making up big words and sounding cool. Because there are people like that. Some of them call themselves philosophers, and the ordinary person can't necessarily tell the difference between the big... Like, take Ravi Zacharias. Now, everybody knows now that he was just about the worst person in the world. He was like a serial sex abuser. But never mind that. Any Christian philosopher I know, someone who takes their Christian faith seriously, has a PhD in philosophy, zero of them took him seriously. Because he was just a big word spouting... just font of nonsense. Like, it was all about play acting, cosplaying as this public intellectual. And like, he didn't really have anything to say on any of the topics that philosophers care about. Yeah. So yeah. And amongst biblical Unitarians, the hatred of philosophy, it's magnified by the following sort of thought. You've got your wonderful Hebrew purity that never had anything to do with Greek nonsense. And then you've got all this ridiculous paganism that somehow is wholly responsible for the Trinity that came in and just swamped and ate up the church. It's really not right. Why is the whole New Testament written in ancient Koine Greek? It's because there was a lot of Hellenistic influence there already. It just isn't true at all that philosophers came in and said, hey, you have to teach the Trinity now. That was really a mistake committed by the monarchical bishop system with an assist from the empire. Hmm. Now, philosophy had something to do with it because...
Well, it's just a tool. So like, it could be used for good or for ill, depending on yeah. what your aim is and what your initial assumptions are, right?
Yep. I mean, so the purists think that there was... I call it the corruption narrative. They think, oh, if we just could have kept it pure in Hebraic, you wouldn't have had all these problems. The way I see the problem is that by late antiquity, by the time of the Cappadocian fathers, philosophy is not in a good state. And a lot of it is just kind of warmed over Platonism with little add-ons from Stoicism and Aristotelianism. So these bishops that knew a little bit of philosophy, yeah, they could use it to prop up the Nicene Creed and do things like that, which was a tremendous mistake. I actually think it would have been better if he had more philosophers in mainstream Christianity that would push back. You know, do you really think God is timeless? You think God can't change or be have any emotion? Like these are common assumptions about God in that time, and they come from Platonism. You think God is simple in the technical sense? I think that's a totally absurd thing for any Christian to say, that God is simple, or that you can't even distinguish different qualities of God. He just is like a geometrical point. There's not any kind of complexity in him, not just parts. If you had more philosophers pushing back that had read rival approaches, I think it wouldn't have been so lockstep in that era.
Would you say that people are intimidated by philosophy as well? It can be kind of like a witchcraft, especially when people encounter a syllogism for the first time and they watch the moves and maybe they don't really know what's happening. And then kazam, you know, here's our conclusion and you can't argue against it. And you think people are just intimidated by that?
Yeah, and there's also a myth. I remember there was a bad Christian movie that had Kevin Sorbo in it. I don't think I saw it, but my friend reviewed it, and it had an evil village atheist philosopher.
Oh, God's Not Dead. Is that the one?
I think so, yeah. One or two, one of those. He like humiliates this Christian kid in class.
Yeah, yeah.
And is just a total, you know, hater of God, essentially. I mean, what's weird is like good philosophers, A, they don't do that to their students. They have more respect than that. And B, a lot of them are theism curious, or they're theists, Jewish and Christian, or they've had mentors and colleagues that they respect who are believers in God, mm-hmm. and they just find the whole thing interesting. Like I had an atheist colleague, I had a couple of atheist colleagues for years at Fredonia, and one of them, what he would do is he would come in, teach the cosmological argument or the design argument, and say, okay, I hope everybody should be in church on Sunday. Atheists, you have no excuse. I have just proven the existence of God. And all the atheists or agnostic kids would be all up in arms and trying to argue back, and he'd be like defending the argument, right? Then he'd come in two classes later, talk about the problem of evil, tell people there's no God. And they kind of realized what he was doing, like he was making them think. That's a valuable gift. He was a good professor.
Yeah.
He did a good job, and a lot of students liked him. And a lot of those students were Christians and other people who believed in God. It is true there are a lot of, there's a higher percentage of atheists amongst philosophy professors. And a lot of them are burned out religious kids that decide it wasn't for serious people. Like when they're Catholics in the eighth grade at the Catholic mm-hmm. school, and they're like, no one's answering my questions. You know, and that sets them on a course. They're like people that would have gone to theology, mm-hmm. but they veered off and became atheists. So there is a higher percentage of those than in the general population, but they run the whole gamut, honestly. So the prejudice against it is kind of weird to me. If you take a class or two from a good professor, you'll just be like, oh man, that's so interesting.
Yeah. Now you're an analytic philosopher, which means you prioritize clear reasoning, transparency of assumptions, and valid logical arguments, right? I don't know if many people know much about analytic philosophy or analytic theology, but I think this is something about you that comes through in the book, where you are very careful to explain your assumptions. You're very careful to lay out your reasoning. You're not trying to pull the wool over anyone's eyes or make a move that somebody couldn't follow if they wanted to. You have the whole chapter 8, crash course in modern logic and critical thinking, you know, this kind of explanation of what's going on. Because when we talk about the subject of the Trinity and we apply analytic philosophy or theology to it, there are some serious issues that emerge. So could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So we're actually living in the greatest golden age of philosophy, and it's almost all analytic philosophy. Ancient Greece had some good couple hundred years in there. the Middle Ages had some good years, late 1700s, late 1600s. But by far more good philosophy is being done well around the world now than way, way more than was done in those earlier times. Most immediately, it's due to a couple of British philosophers named G.E. Moore and Bertrand Russell. But, you know, ultimately, there's a huge influence among on this type of philosophy, which is mostly but not all English language. Even in countries like Japan and Spain, sometimes they will. This is the new Koine Greek for philosophy. So a lot they write it in 20 different languages, but a lot of times they'll go towards English because it's the bigger audience.
Yeah.
But there's a huge influence in the tradition from a couple of great Christian philosophers, namely John Locke and Thomas Reed. Reed died in 1796. He's famous for being the founder of the so-called Common Sense School of Philosophy. So yeah, they value clarity, focusing on things that everybody knows that don't need to be argued for. Like those are the proper starting points for constructing an argument, things that anybody can know if they would just consider it. Clarity, trying to avoid abstractness and just big, stupid, abstract terms whenever possible. There are kinds of philosophy that are super obscure. You know, if you pick up a book by John Duns Scotus, you won't know what hit you. Or if you pick up a book by a lot of so-called continental philosophy of the last 100 years, you'll be, what is this? Some kinds of writing obscurity helps the author. It helps them buffer up their image. And so then you have to go begging back to them for more to try to find. They must mean something, right? This guy's famous. So
yeah,
you got to keep reading and you may never get it in these cases. So to be clear is to be clear enough to be refuted. And it's really kind of an act of humility and also respect for the reader. And the people that taught me to do philosophy were really very good in these ways. And so I just kind of absorbed that from them. So chapter 8, yeah, I used to teach logic and critical thinking. If you look at the doctrine of the Trinity, this issue of this concept of numerical identity immediately comes up. On the face of it, it's right in the Athanasian Creed. So when it says each person individually is God, and yet this one's God, and that one's God. Oh, and they differ from each other. Oh, and there's also only one God. You know, mind blown. That looks like it implies obvious contradictions, yeah, and impossibilities. People like Bill Craig jump in. No, no, no. You don't need the Athanasian Creed. Just stick with the Bible and the Nicene Creed. And when it says that each person is God, it just means is each one is divine, and only the Trinity is identical with the one God. My point is he's trying to build a Trinitarian theology and avoid these contradictions that usually have to do with claims about identity. And if you look at my Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy article, basically all of those theories are trying to come up with a contradiction free Trinity theory, except one which embraces true contradictions, but that's an outlier. Another one which embraces apparent but not real contradictions. So the stuff that's in chapter 8 is stuff that pretty much any analytic philosopher knows, or at least the ones that have taken some logic. Mm-hmm. They're navigating around these problems as they're trying to be Trinitarians in a way that actually makes sense rather than refuting itself. Just take one obvious point about identity, and I think it's really a point that anybody knows. If this just is that, if this is numerically identical to that, then this and that can't differ. So if it's true that Abram just is Abraham, and Abram had a wife, well, then Abraham had a wife. Because mm-hmm. we're just really talking about one thing. And, yeah, and this guy can't at one time have a wife and not have a wife, right? You start off with what look like two characters and you realize, oh, they're really one and the same. Okay, so then they, it's really just one thing, has to always be the way it is. Just that point, I mean, it tells you that it's a mistake to think that the Father just is God and the Son just is God, because it would follow that the Father just is the Son, and then whatever is true of one would have to be true of the other. Mm-hmm. So the Father sent his human Son to save the world, therefore the Son sent his human Son to save the world. Wrong, right?
We got a problem.
The Son died on the cross for our sins, therefore the Father died on the cross. Because if they're really one and the same things would have to be true of them. Mm-hmm. it's very interesting to understand that. I've been banging on about this stuff for years. The apologists don't know about this. Most of them haven't taken a course in modern deductive logic. And it's not like in the standard apologetics materials. It should be, but it's not. Yeah. And so they hear me saying stuff about identity, though. Oh, you crazy guy. You're just making stuff up. You and your crazy Unitarian claims about identity.
Yeah, you're just a bunch of rationalists. You don't accept divine authority or revelation. And that's why,
yep.
That's why you don't get the Trinity or something.
Yeah, and you're cooking whatever you say about this so-called numerical identity. You're just cooking this in advance, so it's going to be bad for Trinitarians. And it's like, no, I'm not. This is just stuff that logicians and most analytic philosophers know. And it's actually just kind of part of the common sense that God gave you. And when you understand this, it does help navigate this whole field very well.
Wouldn't you say that logic, in a sense, is divine? You know, like that God himself, I don't know what his relationship to logic would be, if he generated it, or if it is just sort of like an obvious thing that exists, if God exists, or what that would be. But like, presumably God is the clearest of reasoners.
And yes.
So the clearer that we can reason, the more closely we come to how God reasons. And so you see what I'm saying? Like, it seems like almost it would be a divine, you're trying to tap into a divine understanding of something, really.
Yeah. There are some Christian philosophers that try to argue that you should think that God created logic, or only God could explain why logic works, or something like that. I don't endorse any such arguments like that. Logic just has to do with what implies what, essentially. If you make a claim, just call it P, and you make another claim, call it Q. Like, something that's logically implied by that is the compound claim, P and Q. And this is just a fact about any two claims whatsoever. If those first two are true, then the third compound claim also has to be true. Mm-hmm. So that would be a valid argument to go from P and Q to therefore P and Q. And so it's just stuff like that. Any language is making claims. Language does different things. It doesn't only make claims. If you say ouch, or if you ask a question, you're not making a claim. But language, one of the main purposes is to make claims. And then because of that, there'll be logical relationships between a lot of sentences. And I'm not talking about some point about English here, or Greek or Chinese, like any possible language. If there's a language of God and a language of angels, and they're making claims, there's going to be logical relationships between those claims that seem unchanging and necessary, like they couldn't be different than they are. Logic is just kind of understanding what follows from what, and being able to separate a valid argument from an invalid argument doesn't really by itself tell you what to believe. So yeah, I think in a sense, logic is built into the human mind, the capacity to understand all of this. We all sort of pick up on the basics of this just by learning to use any language. And then we're primed already to understand. If you take a logic class, you're really just kind of making explicit a lot of things that you kind of intuitively already believed.
Yeah.
And it helps sharpen you up. You know, it's kind of doing mental push-ups. So it's really a fun thing. A lot of Christians have loved logic for a long, long time, as long as there's been formal logic. It basically goes back to Plato and Aristotle and the Stoics, but it's particularly taken a more kind of mathematical type of turn since the mid-1800s. So the logic, like what I'm briefly explaining in that chapter 8, that type of logic is a modern phenomenon, and it does more things than the ancient ways of sorting the arguments did.
Yeah.
So it's more powerful. It's an advance on them.
All right. Well, let's move on to another subject. You say in the book, in mainstream Christianity, it has long been popular for layperson and theologian alike to sweep a lot of apparent contradictions under the mystery rug, resulting in a large, unseemly bulge. I love that line. Why don't you think it's valid to just say God is superior to us, and therefore his divine nature is necessarily beyond our grasp, therefore Trinity?
Well, to use the old medieval term, that's a non sequitur. I mean, the conclusion doesn't follow from the premises.
Yeah, but what about this idea of mystery? Aren't God's ways mysterious? And, you know, who are we to think we can understand him? It's hubris.
Yeah, so there's a long tradition, and especially I think the Protestant reformers like Luther really kind of pushed this more than ancient and some other medieval people did. There's a long tradition of considering an appeal to mystery to be a get out of jail free card that will let you get around any difficulty that you run into in theology. And just a couple of basic points about it. Yeah, I discuss at length, like, what do they think they're doing here? How is this even supposed to be reasonable? I review a book by a very smart reformed guy named James Anderson, who's like the most sophisticated mystery defender probably that's ever existed. But just a couple of basic points. One point is there isn't anybody in scripture that runs up against an apparent contradiction and then says, well, that's okay because it's a holy mystery. Like, a mystery in the New Testament is mainly something that previously was not known, but which has now been revealed, right? Like Christ uniting Jew and Gentile together into his body, into followers. That's a mystery. So Paul's just not defending against contradictions at all. It's really a bad habit because apparent contradictions are just in and of themselves very strong evidence of falsehood. You've got a couple of claims that can't be true. Like, if you think Jesus knows everything, but he also doesn't know the day or hour of his future return, okay, well then that second part seems to entail that it's not the case that Jesus knows everything.
Indeed.
So we're saying Jesus knows everything, and we just imply that it's not the case that Jesus knows everything. That's the P and the not P of a contradiction. And it's not smart. I mean, it sounds smart to some people, but it in fact is not smart to just say, but it's a holy mystery and leave it at that, because we don't think contradictions are true. And when we're taking a source seriously, like we're interpreting the Bible, and we run into a contradiction, we say to ourselves, well, maybe I don't want to say the writer's that confused that he's accidentally contradicting himself, like asserting and denying the same thing. So I'm going to back up a couple of steps and see if I could interpret it differently, where he's saying P and not P, but some other thing, some cute, whatever. Now, people like James Anderson, they realize that apparent contradictions are evidence of real contradictions. And he doesn't think that contradictions can be true.
Okay.
But his basic idea is, yeah, but the Bible could provide so much support for this and then also support for this over here. They look like they contradict, but we should just think, well, but they don't really contradict, but we just can't even explain how. We don't really understand at all how. Maybe we'll understand it someday. Like, he thinks that's a reasonable thing. And I don't think it is. It's always more reasonable to go reconsider your interpretation. Now, I mean, humans aren't perfect. Like, if you're reading something by Dale Tuggy and you're reading chapter 1 over here and chapter 7 over there, I mean, I might in fact be contradicting myself, that I just misremembered something and got confused and so on.
Yeah.
But to the extent that we think this is divinely revealed, like, we shouldn't be willing to go there to think that the author is confused, not if we can help it.
Right.
And philosophers call this the principle of charity.
Yeah, that, charitable reading.
Yeah, it's uncharitable. You're treating the author as confused to see him as propounding a contradiction. So it's best not to do that. It's interesting. A lot of Christian philosophers, they do see mystery appeals as the intellectual laziness that they usually are. Because a lot of times they really don't have views about, you know, can contradictions be true? I don't know. You know, should we just think they're apparent but not real contradictions? I don't know. Anyway, it sounds good and I'm sick of talking about this. So I'm just going to say it's a holy mystery and get out of Dodge. Like, a lot of Christian philosophers that work on theological stuff, they do recognize that as just a totally lazy, unprincipled move that shows lack of concern for the truth.
You talked about this in your previous book too, What is the Trinity? This whole idea of the mystery mongering and just this bulge under the carpet. Let's switch to talk about the B.B. Warfield approach. You cover this in one of the earlier chapters, which is trying to affirm the Trinity without necessarily appealing to creeds and councils and the authority of the magisterium. Maybe you could just obviously we can't get into the full detail, but just summarize, like, what was his approach? Like, why do we even care? Why is that significant to us? And like, what is the flaw?
I mean, just on the face of it, if you consider any fully developed doctrine of the Trinity, like look at what the Westminster Confession says about the Trinity, or what it says in the Southern Baptist Creed, or even just the Athanasian Creed. And then you look at what's actually in the Bible, like you realize there's a vast distance between these two things. Like, how am I ever going to show that all the claims that constitute the doctrine of the Trinity are actually found in Scripture? And so B.B. Warfield, this late 1800s, early 1900s scholar, reformed guy, he pioneered this sort of little trick. He said, look, it's just three claims. Just grant me these three claims. How hard can it be? Mm-hmm. Three little old teeny little tiny claims. Mm-hmm. We'll just find those three in Scripture, and that's all we need. Bam, doctrine of the Trinity. And then he gives you three sentences. And then, as I point out, well, it's three sentences, but it's not three claims. It looks like it's really like seven claims. So he's kind of minimizing.
Smuggling
he's kind of
in,
spinning yeah. there. And then even when you look at the seven claims, there's nothing about same essence. There's nothing about generation and procession. There's not even anything clearly about the triune God. So what are we doing here? Like, we, I give the analogy, I can't slam dunk, but if you give me like a basketball hoop designed for four-year-olds, like all of a sudden it's really easy to slam dunk, you know? So they're lowering the hoop down to where they're able to slam it. And right. it's kind of a silly procedure. I take someone who's a real scholar and a serious scholar in a sense, but also an apologist, Rob Bowman. And, you know, he's got, what is it? Five sentences, but it really turns out to be like 13 claims. Right, so he's trying a little harder, but you know, I'm arguing, look, you're leaving stuff out. One thing they don't realize that they do a lot is when they give just two or three or four or five or seven or whatever few sentences, they end up giving sentences that a Unitarian subordinationist like Origen could agree with. But they don't mean to be doing that, but that is what they've done. Like, I can show you how Origen would just go down your list and be like, great, buddy. Yeah, but he's not a Trinitarian, or a modalist could just sit there and agree with your sentences. So whatever the doctrine of the Trinity is, and let's be honest, nobody really knows, but whatever it's supposed to be, it's supposed to, by definition, it's supposed to be monotheistic. It's supposed to, by definition, rule out, quote, Sabellianism or modalism, and it's supposed to rule out any kind of subordinationism. So if it's compatible with any with those two opposite, quote, classical heresies, you're not talking about a doctrine of the Trinity in the Orthodox sense.
So it's too broad.
Really, it can't be proof text at all. I argue that you'd have to show that it's the best explanation of all the texts overall. And I don't think anybody's hardly even tried to do that yet.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Heresy is a big, nasty word. You've got a whole chapter about dropping H-bombs. Of course, I remember back when you presented that at a conference years ago, when you had a little more brown hair than gray. I'm heading in that direction myself. It comes on the beard first for me. But you have a whole chapter about this, and you know, we can't go into great detail, but let me ask you this. Should Christians drop H-bombs? Should we call other Christians heretics? When would that be justified? Or should we just like never identify anything as heresy?
I kind of ruthlessly point out in that chapter that the standard Protestant way is just to pound the table and just assert that some of these old Catholic things are essential, and denying them is therefore heresy. And there's not really any good reason for it, because Scripture doesn't say it, and they're really just going on Catholic tradition that they haven't bothered to reform properly. And then I work a lot with this really great piece by the evangelical scholar Craig Blomberg, where he talks about, you know, what did Jesus and the apostles really get mad about? They don't talk much about heresy. The word heresis mostly means like a sect or a party, like a group. It's mostly mostly but not always a neutral term. It's like the Pharisees and Sadducees would be heresies in that sense, or the early Christians could be called a sect in that sense. But what it later came to mean was people that have wandered off of the Catholic reservation, essentially. And there's an assumption that they always have some rotten heresy arc that started the whole thing. And that's why the heresy is named what it is. The paradigmatic heresy is Arianism. Then they bang on about Sabellianism based on this obscure character, Sabellius, that we hardly know anything about at all.
Yeah.
And then it gets into the whole tradition of heresiology, which, as I explore, has a lot of stupid features about it that just aren't very helpful. It really kind of prevents critical thinking in a lot of ways. You just pigeonhole it with this heresy label, and then you can dismiss it as pseudo-Christianity and just forget about it without ever understanding why it's wrong if it is. One thing the New Testament talks a lot more about is false teachers, and that has a very similar meaning, right? Not just false about any old thing. You know, maybe you've got a weird interpretation. I give the example of Irenaeus thought Jesus was in his 50s when he died, which is weird, but probably not something that we would like divide over. Or you could come up with a more trivial example if you don't like that one. So there definitely are people teaching false things and twisting and misinterpreting scripture. And it's so bad that you ought to disfellowship from them. So if that's what you want to call heresy, go right ahead. But you have to be careful, because there are things that are gray areas, and the term has so much baggage, and it's so closely tied to small C Catholic tradition that I don't firmly answer that. I just want us to help. I want to help us see how institutional based the Catholic thinking about heresy is, and how just groundless and just floating in freely in the air is the normal Protestant approach. And then realize that, yes, false teaching is a problem, but also divisiveness is a huge problem. That's part of the problem with heresiological tradition and with people that self-appoint themselves to be heresy hunters. Some of them are just enthusiastic dividers and enthusiastic accusers, and have a lot of opinions that aren't necessarily all that justified. Yeah, it's very serious to say somebody's twisting the gospel and therefore no other disciple should have to do with them, but sometimes it definitely has to be done.
Yeah. Well, it's crazy too, because the logic of heresy was what justified burning people at the stake, right? So this is not a small matter. It has serious consequences. Now, that's not happening today anymore, thank God, but
thanks to Protestants, it's not.
Yeah.
And the United States of America that somehow convinced the Catholics that religious tolerance was a good idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, who would have guessed that in the year 1400, right?
Yeah. Nobody. I think pretty much people said, well, this person is leading people to hell with their false ideas, so we're going to visualize that by burning that person now. And then as soon as they die, they start burning in hell as well, as like maybe a deterrent to people not to listen to their teachings. It's awful, horrible behavior for a Christian to do to a Christian.
Yep.
Just absolutely the worst.
But it survives now, except now you only face social death.
Right.
Right. So say you're a biblical Unitarian, you go to an evangelical church. I mean, to be honest, some of them will just simply tolerate you, like, oh, that's kind of weird. I wonder why he thinks that, you know. But there's this script that comes from Catholic tradition that guy in your pew is a cancer. And if you leave him there, he's going to kill the whole body. And so there's no reasoning with him. He's probably a liar and tricky. God knows he's probably reading philosophy, for goodness sakes. So reprimand him once and make him read James White or something, but then have nothing to do with him. Throw his lousy rear end out of the church. I mean, I know a lot of people, I've met a lot of people who've been treated like that, and that's kind of the kinder, gentler heresiological tradition. You can't kill people anymore. People frequently joke about that online, thinking that that's just hilarious, by the way. Yeah. Ortho bros, Catholic bros, Reformed bros, they're like, you know, why don't we burn people anymore? We wouldn't have annoying guys like Dale Tuggy and Sean Finnegan if we would just burn them. Right, not realizing that their lives depend on religious freedom completely, that they could have been burned back in the day. you know, as Reformed, say, or Anabaptist or whatever, or Orthodox. It's interesting. I give this example. Paul finds out that some of the people in Corinth don't believe in resurrection, or they think it's already happened.
Right.
Which is a very big mistake, in my opinion, either one of those. But he just kind of gently corrects them and teaches them. So I think that has to be the default, you know, quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to become angry. And then, okay, if someone's really a wrecking ball of destruction, bringing division and leading people away from the kingdom, then yes, you do have to kick people out. Mm-hmm. But nothing in the new covenant authorizes us to kill people, or I think even to viciously ostracize them, like from your family, for instance.
Yeah. If people want to know more, they can read your chapter about heretics and heresy. Just as we're drawing things to a close here, who do you think should read this book? Who do you think this book is really going to be ideally helpful for?
Anybody that's a Christian philosopher, anybody that's taken a few philosophy classes, anybody who's into theology and is not totally afraid of analytic theology. It's just somebody that's not afraid of a little bit of philosophy when it's clearly explained. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm engaging and targeting arguments at the Trinitarians and trying to have them be fair, reasonable arguments that are based on scripture and common sense. And so I think also somebody who is engaging the other side, mm-hmm. and maybe wants to clarify their thinking a little bit on topics like heresy or the concept of numerical identity or what's going on in John 17, 1 through 3, or 1 Corinthians 8, 4 through 6.
Fulfillment fallacy, you talk about that. You talk about early high Christology. You talk about Richard Bauckham's divine identity. You talk about Larry Hurtado's worship argument. So there's just tons and
relative
tons.
Identity.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are some topics that you kind of need an analytic theologian like relative identity to even kind of understand what's going on. So yeah, it's definitely not for everybody. It's not a beginner book. And yet I tried very hard to make it accessible, particularly to someone who's maybe had a little bit of college. There's a lot of smart people that haven't, and a lot of people teach themselves anyway, but like a typical reader probably would have had a little bit of college somewhere. It's a little bit, it's like the UCA presentations. Our Unitarian Christian movement has a ton of content creators that do a really good job addressing the lay level. Mm-hmm. Our UCA presentations are aimed more at the been to seminary level, or at least been very influenced by people who've been to seminary. And it's more like that.
Okay.
So yeah, not for everybody, but I hope accessible enough to the right folks.
So would you say Trinitarians should read it too, though? I mean, did you write it with
absolutely.
Them in mind?
Yeah, absolutely. Because getting it out of the Bible is harder than you think. The stuff about logic is not a Unitarian plot. It's just part of the common sense that God has blessed you with. And relative identity, I think, should be rejected for biblical reasons, which I think a Trinitarian should agree with. So there's quite a lot that's of interest to a thinking Trinitarian in this.
Very good. So if you would like to meet Dale Tuggy, you're going to be at a couple of conferences in the next little while here. You've got the Unitarian Christian Alliance Conference held outside of London, July 30th to August 1st. So if you're... Yeah. In the UK, or you know, in that region that you could travel to the London area, you could meet Dale at that event. Also, you're going to be at the Tempe, Arizona conference in October 22nd to the 24th here in the US. So those would be good times to, you know, if you buy the book, maybe come and get it signed. Meet.
Get it signed. I'll probably be showing up with some copies of it that you could get for a good small donation at both of those events. And at the London one, I'm actually going to be presenting some material from a portion of the book.
Very good.
But there's a lot of other speakers in the lineup too. There's a total of 8 presentations at that conference, which is the most we've ever had.
Of course, you also have a podcast called Trinity's Podcast, which has tons of episodes, lots of content. What else am I forgetting to mention where people can follow you? Well, you have another book right behind you there. What is the Trinity? A much shorter, easier book than this one, but also very helpful.
That one's really for Trinitarians, just to kind of introduce the subject and thinking about the topic. Mm-hmm. It's not really making a case for our view. Yeah, it's a confusing topic, and it's confusing because Trinitarians think different things. It comes with this big historical background. Yeah, no, thanks. You mentioned all the things I think that you should. So cool. I'm on social media occasionally. I need to make some more videos about those very things that you mentioned, the conference and the book.
Yeah, yeah. So once again, the book is called Monotheism, Heresy, and the Bible. It's by Dale Tuggy. You can get it on Amazon. Thanks so much, Professor, Dr. Philosopher Dale Tuggy, for speaking with me today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Sean. Appreciate it.
Well, that brings this interview to an end. What did you think? Come on over to restitutio.org and find episode 661, Monotheism, Heresy, and the Bible, and leave your questions, comments, and feedback there. On episode 659, How Important Is That Doctrine with Michael Hughes, Andrew wrote in saying, Hi, Sean. I've been listening to your excellent podcast for about a year now and really enjoyed your latest episode, 659, with your guest, Michael Hughes, a Christadelphian Christian. I myself am not a Christadelphian and, in fact, had never heard of Christadelphians until I was introduced to a small group of Christadelphians here in Glasgow around 3.5 years ago. Having spent several Sundays with the group, and to cut a long story short, on my first visit, I was gobsmacked to discover that Christadelphians do not believe Satan, the devil, to be a real literal being, and was hoping you would have asked Michael the elephant in the room question, where does the belief that Satan, the devil, is a real literal being stand in the rating system? I would not want this to come across in any way as being a facetious question, just genuinely interested to know. Please keep up the fantastic work, and avid fan, Andy. Well, thanks so much, Andy, for taking the time to listen to this and writing in. In fact, Michael Hughes is not a Christadelphian. He just grew up Christadelphian and then later on left the church. I'm not really sure what his current position is on the devil. He has not been with the Christadelphians for quite some time. And I suppose the reason why is because of this doctrinal approach that he has, where he is not recognizing all doctrines as equally important. I'm not 100% sure that all Christadelphians see it that way, but Michael is actually part of a different group now called Living Hope New Zealand, where he's serving as an elder with Pastor Zach Mayo. So you have to forgive me for not probing him on the devil question. I actually would be interested to hear his thoughts on that. I too am gobsmacked that Christadelphians don't believe in a literal devil. And that's a subject that I think is worth considering. I don't think most Christians will consider that salvational one way or the other. There may be some Christadelphians that would say, well, if you do believe in the devil, that's another god and it's idolatry and you're going to hell. So maybe that would be a line of reasoning for some of them. I don't want to speak for them because I am not a Christadelphian. And to be honest, I don't know any Christadelphians in my area, but I have Christadelphian friends who live in other areas. And I think they do have some sort of variety of views on this. But if you are a Christadelphian listening in, I know there are Christadelphians who listen to this podcast. You are certainly welcome here, even if we disagree on the devil subject. A wise man once said, chew the grapes and spit out the seeds. So you can benefit from what is helpful and then discard the rest. That goes for everybody, not just Christadelphians. But at some point, it would be great to have that conversation. I think Andrew is right, not necessarily with Michael because he's not a Christadelphian in current standing with Christadelphia at large. But I think it would be great to hear perhaps a debate on this subject. So the problem, I think, is less on the side of the Christadelphians and more on the side of the non-Christadelphians because most people are not studying this issue in depth to prove the existence of Satan because, let's face it, pretty much all Christians believe in Satan, whether Catholic, Orthodox, Protestant, Restorationist, whatever. Like, everybody just believes that there is such a thing as the devil. I don't think for most of us it's well defined in the sense of, like, is it a fallen angel or is it some other way of thinking?
because the Bible is not very clear on that, but that the devil exists and tempted Jesus seems just a face value reading of Matthew 4 and Luke 4, that demons exist, that Jesus cast them out, that Jesus spoke to them, that they spoke back to him. This all seems to be pretty clear from the Gospels. And certainly Paul has a fairly robust demonology as well. So perhaps it would be great to have a Christadelphian versus non-Christadelphian debate on the subject of the devil. If any of you out there are interested, please let me know. You can come on to restitutio.org and find today's episode, 661, and leave your comment there. Or you could just email me, sean@restitutio.org, and we could set something up. I think that would be really great, so long as it's done in a respectful manner. On that same episode, Paul wrote in saying, "Always love your videos, but this one even better than usual. I really appreciate the perspectives y'all shared in this, especially as they relate to promoting Christian unity. I think that's one of the areas that the church at large continues to fail in the most. I especially like the combination of this really good systematic approach to this kind of question and how it has the potential to be used to solve the disunity problem. Thank you for sharing this." Yeah, I really enjoyed Michael's system as well. I mean, it seems like a really obvious move in retrospect to ask the Bible and search out the question, well, what does the Bible consider essential rather than what does my denomination consider essential? It just seems like such an obvious thing, and yet nobody's doing it. So I think it is certainly worthwhile to consider and to recognize that there's actually a lot of toleration allowed in Scripture for varying beliefs on this or that, and just a narrower collection of beliefs and practices as that are required for salvation. So yeah, thanks for writing in, Paul. MJ writes in saying, "I'm personally not a fan of the post-Reformation habit of thinking in terms of essential and secondary doctrines. One thing I think Eastern Orthodoxy gets right is its narrative, covenantal way of telling the gospel. I don't agree with the story of Christ it ultimately tells, but I appreciate the approach in asking whether a teaching distorts the apostolic story rather than asking which doctrines are essential. That's a different way of thinking about truth." She goes on, "To me, God's revelation isn't just a list of beliefs to check off. It's a whole picture, a story that begins at creation and ends at the new creation through God's covenant with his people. Any individual doctrine capable of reshaping that story into something else matters. Not because you've picked up one false belief, but because you now hold a false story. It's just a different way of thinking about it. I think the systematic approach actually strips certain parts of the story of their significance. Take the creation narrative, for example. I've always held that if you get creation and Adam wrong, you get Christ wrong, no matter how sound your baseline Christology is. And that extends further to implications of God's character and soteriology. Systematic thinking downplays the importance of the old earth, young earth divide. The reason Jesus or Stephen before his stoning started at Abraham was that the creation narrative was settled. The Jews accepted a young earth. It wasn't even a debate. Today, though, with the theory of evolution pervading our thinking, I do believe the gospel has to start with creation because how you interpret that changes the whole story." And then she finishes up by saying, "Belief, I think, is more naturally wired to receiving and understanding a true story than to memorizing a hierarchy of propositions. We don't see Jesus or the apostles handing down a ranked list of doctrines. They proclaimed what God had done and called people to receive it and live in it." Well, thanks for writing in. Some interesting thoughts there. As far as salvation goes, one of Michael Hughes' points was that the gospel and avoiding certain sinful behaviors that are associated with God's judgment are really the core of what is essential. I think that was like level one and level two. And so he would certainly agree with you on that. The gospel itself is the information required to be saved. It's not the whole Bible. But I disagree with you about the value of systematic theology. I don't think it is necessary for all Christians to have a clear systematic theology. I would agree with you on that. But I think that saying that it's an invalid pursuit or that it doesn't have any value, which I'm not sure exactly if you're saying that, but But if that's what you're saying, I would depart from you on that. I think it is very helpful, at least for those of us with very analytic minds, to be able to organize our beliefs into categories, which is all that systematic theology really is. And the simple fact is, everybody is already doing this to some degree when they read the text. They have their assumptions, they have their beliefs, and they are informing how they're reading. The problem, however, is that people typically are not self-aware of what those assumptions are, of what those beliefs are. Let's take, for example, the idea that the modern concept of monotheism is what ancient people believed. And so the modern concept of monotheism is the idea that there's just one supreme God and really no other spiritual beings exist except for sort of like lower level angels or messengers, right? And so you take that position and then you superimpose that on the ancient text, which is a text that comes from a world of polytheism, a world where everyone had all these different gods. And you read, for example, Exodus 20, verse 1 and 2 and 3, where God introduces himself, "I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. You shall have no other gods before me." And we say, okay, look, there it is, monotheism, there's no other gods. But that's just you reading in your modern assumption. You know, if you actually do the hard work of putting your own self in their position and seeing through their eyes, you would say, okay, well, I'm just coming out of Egypt where there were lots of gods, Apis and Hathor and Nut and Atum and Ra and all these different gods, right? And now we're through the Red Sea, we're standing at the base of this mountain, it's on fire, it's shaking, I'm terrified, and I hear the voice of some god who is self-identifying as Yahweh and saying, "You shall have no other gods before me." What is the assumption of that ancient Israelite going to be? The assumption of the ancient Israelite is that, yeah, there's other gods. They are not in the same category as Yahweh. Yahweh is supreme. He is above them. So they exist, but he's above them. And so my point is not really so much to argue that the ancient gods exist, which I think is somewhat debatable. My point is, if you're unaware of your systematic theological beliefs or your modern day assumptions, you're just going to read them into the text. And that, I think, is the great danger of being unaware of one's systematic theology. Now, I'm not saying this is required for all Christians. I am not saying that everybody needs to study theology and listen to my podcast episodes. You know, I realize that the majority of you out there listening to me are theology nerds, are Bible nerds, are people that for whatever reason are like me, and you just are thirsty and you're just hungry for a greater understanding of these things and you want to know more and you're not satisfied with the everyday generic boilerplate understanding of things, and you want to grow and you want to learn and you want to get answers to questions and you want to hear different perspectives so that you can understand yourself better and possibly even change your beliefs over time, which is what restorationists do. Like, we're genuinely seeking to improve over time. So I want to agree with the commenter on some of this, but as far as like having the gospel, and you know, the gospel is a story. I agree with that. It is a narrative. You know, God created a good world. It got spoiled by sin, and God made promises to heal our world, and he called Israel, and so on. You know, you just go through the, you know, it depends on how detailed you, how granular you want to be in telling the story, but you know, eventually we get to Jesus and how he died for our sins, God raised him from the dead, and that he's coming back to heal our world, to bring God's kingdom on the earth. You know, this is the storyline of Scripture, and it is the good news that we have to tell people. And I do really appreciate MJ's point about evaluating beliefs in how much they distort that gospel message or not. So I think that is actually a really powerful point, but I disagree with some of the negativity towards systematic theology. Well, that's going to be it for today. If you'd like to support us, you can do that at restitutio.org. Thanks to those of you who are supporting us, especially those who are supporting on a monthly basis. It helps so much. I will catch you next week. And remember, the truth has nothing to fear.